evening, everyone, and welcome to MOR Chat. I guess it's evening on the East Coast and good afternoon on the West Coast if you're in Pacific time. Tonight we have with us a very special guest. We have George Gallo with us tonight, and we're going to talk about the Pennsylvania Impressionists, specifically Edward Redfield, and we're also going to talk about painting large because that's what George does. He goes out, paints plein air out in the field with large canvases, very much like Edward Redfield did as well. So we're going to talk to him a little bit about that, starting canvases and how he finishes the canvas all in one standing while he's out in, painting plein air. And we'll probably get into a lot of different topics where that is concerned as well. Wanted to cover a few things before I bring in Barbara and George to talk about all of the things that we just said. One of the things is we have a show coming up in January. It'll be January 17th, and we will have Quang Ho with us, and we'll be talking about the evolution of seeing and how important that is to all the different aspects. But we're really going to drill down deep and talk about seeing. It's something that I just got off the phone actually with Quang a little while ago, and it was something he really wanted to delve into and talk about in depth. So that's what we'll do on January 17th, and we'll start that at 7 o'clock Eastern time as well. And also wanted to mention that the Ammo Painting Challenges are now out on Facebook. The Ammo Painting Challenge website will be going down, so you may want to join us on Facebook if you have a Facebook account. And the first challenge is up. Basically, you have a challenge to finish a painting with 100 brush strokes, and that's it. So people have been posting those, and they've been coming out really interesting. It's really been showing a lot of different abstract type of designs that they start with, and it's surprising how fast you can use 100 brush strokes. And so it's getting folks to think a little bit about how they're applying paint and what they're doing in the first foundational parts of the painting. So join us on Facebook. There's a link out on the Ammo website, so just click that link. It will take you right to the page and ask to join us, and I'll be happy to do that, to welcome you into the group. So with that, I want to talk to Barbara for a few minutes. Hello, Barbara. How are you doing?
Hey, Linda. Hey, George.
Hey.
Doing well. Yeah, George is here. Hi, George. Come on in.
Hi, how
say
are you?
Hi.
Hey.
Fine. How are you guys? Yeah.
We're doing well. The weather just changed out here in New Mexico and got very, very cold. And so it's now chilly when you go outside to paint. And I've been painting regularly, even though Christmas is upon us. So, anyway, I'm very excited to talk to George and hear what he has to say. And we were having a good talk about paint and paint texture right before the show started. So, this is very exciting.
I always enjoy talking with George. I've had a couple of conversations with him offline, and I always feel inspired when I get done talking with you, George, to go and paint.
You're very
I love the positive energy and all that when we paint and when we talk. It's just really cool. So hoping that we'll inspire everyone. Hopefully everybody will pick up their brushes tonight. So
that would be great.
Yeah. So I'm gonna go launch into our first question, and naturally that
Lay it on me.
Okay, sweet. The first question I have is, I watched you paint a really large painting, and I can't remember the dimensions, but I'm thinking it's something like 3 foot by 4 foot, something around that.
It was a 48 by 60.
Okay, 48 by 60 at weekend with the Masters. And then I also saw you paint a 16 by 20 the next day.
Right.
That's
because I was tired. Yeah.
The big one wore you out, huh?
Yeah.
We talked about it. You finished that, the 48 by, what was it, 16? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I should have written it down. And I saw you finish that in about 4 or 5 hours. And naturally, the 16 by 20 took less than that. But still, the attention to detail that you had, you know, even in the large 48 by 60, you know, it was the same. I mean, like if you take that 16 by 20 and blow it up, it would have that same attention to detail. And when you paint plein air, you typically paint with what size canvases?
Me? I paint all different sizes. I have a tendency to like to paint the big ones. You know, like for instance, I just I don't even know if I told you this when we spoke last. Elaine Adams has a gallery, you know, the American Legacy Gallery, and she just took me on as one of the artists.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm really excited about it because I'm in some really good company with, you know, painters that are also friends of mine, you know, like, you know, Alexi Steele and Jeremy Lipking, and these guys are my buddies, you know, so it's nice to be have my work hanging next to them. But to answer your question, she came over and looked at a lot of my 48 by 60s that I'd done outside, and she goes, oh, these are splendid, and they're wonderful, and, you know, I get the same question all the time, is, you know, how can you paint something so large so quickly? And my typical answer, is, which is really the truth, it, you know, it took years to figure out how to do it, you know, but... You know, to answer your original question, she said, "Do you have any smaller paintings?" You know, so you know, I said, "Yeah, I've got some." And she said, "Would you go out and, you know, would you go out maybe and, you know, do some 16x20s and 18x24s?" So this past weekend, I went out and I did a bunch of plein air, you know, smaller ones. So I did like 4 paintings over the weekend.
Okay.
What?
Were you gonna say something else, George? Or?
No. I think that's it. But I mean, I think you said, the original question was like, do I always paint large paintings outside? I mean, I like doing it. It's, again, I think we may have had this same conversation last time. I'm a big believer in order to find your own personal voice as an artist, you know, you can't find it and you can't invent it and you can't manipulate it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Your voice comes over a period of time of trying things you like, trying things, you know what I mean, of reaching for stuff. And most of the times I find that your voice really will happen if you take yourself out of the equation. And I don't, and I know that's that always seems like a difficult concept to grasp. Should I talk about this, or should I,
yeah,
just go on off?
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay.
Why don't we talk about? Remember the conversation we had offline about handwriting?
Yes.
Yeah. Talk to it from that perspective.
Well, you know, handwriting is something like you're the one that said it actually, and it was.
That's okay.
No, I can't take credit for something you said. It was actually very astute. You know, you said that I'm going to screw up what you said now. I mean, but you said that basically as children we're taught how to write, we're very, very careful about the letters and the way we create them, and we try to do them exactly the way, you know, we see them on a blackboard in front of us. And then over time we develop our own way of writing the letters, and yet they're recognizable to everyone as those letters, but only us can write them that specific way, and they're as unique as our personalities. You know, I mean, that's pretty much what you said, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think that's very true about painting, and I think the way you get there is because you're not thinking about the letters anymore. You're just reacting because you've written so much that you've developed your own handwriting. You know, I think that's what happens in painting, and in a way, it's a very similar process. I mean, what I think happens, what I mean about taking yourself out of the equation is, which also goes to painting large paintings, one of the most interesting things that when I was reading about Redfield was he was one of those painters that I think was just incredibly honest, and you know, he was honest in his approach, and he was honest with what he saw. I don't think he was trying to go for anything that I would call, you know, egoist, you know, which I think a lot of those early 19th century a lot of those early 20th century American painters were doing, you know, and I think sometimes when you set yourself up, when you put yourself too much in a comfort zone, you're going to fall back on the things that you're familiar with, and you're not going to grow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A great way to grow which Redfield said it himself, and I got, because I was reading this book of all of his letters that he wrote to other painters with some correspondence, was that when he was painting a large painting outside and he didn't have enough time to do it, he had to start inventing all these shorthands in order to get through it. And while he was in that process of invention and tearing through the painting, you know, and not being terribly comfortable, not being able to lean on things that he knew, not being able to lean on convention, not being able to lean on these things, you start to, A, create your own language, and B, you can't be ego involved, you know what I mean? You can't be worried about, am I messing up? And it's in those moments that you really find yourself, and it's in those moments that you really become an artist. Because I think the best type of outdoor painting is when you're working furiously, and then at some point you stop and you look back and you go, holy cow, how did that happen? You know, that's when you're really in a moment. That's when it's really getting zen, and that's when you're really creating great art, I think. You know, because if you're controlling, in, and I mean this in a negative way, every single aspect of what you're doing, and every, you know, you're always in complete and total, and I mean control in a negative way. I don't mean in a positive way. You're actually in the most control when you're not in control of the piece at all, if that makes any sense. It's like, I think Richard Schmidt said in his book, when a jockey is riding a horse, you know, there's that moment between the horse and the jockey of who's really doing what, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's that moment between, you know, your surrender to the horse and the horse surrendering to you. I think it's in that moment of painting that you really find out what you're made of, and you have to have, you know, the guts to let go, not get so concerned with the outcome, you know, just get caught up in the moment of creation, you know, enjoy that moment, because then the best work, in my opinion, and I think I'm right because I've been doing this a long time, is the painting itself becomes a byproduct in some strange way of you releasing to something bigger than you, and releasing to what you see in front of you. And in those moments, you know, you've taken yourself out of the equation in some way. You know, you're not reacting, you're not judging, you're not getting into all that ego nonsense, and you're just creating from the purest place. And to hopefully answer your question, painting large outdoors when there's not a lot of time will certainly put you in that mindset, you know. I hope that I answered that properly.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, when I think about doing this thing called painting, one of the things is, you know, I do a lot of study. Everybody does a lot of study. And then there's this point where you just stop doing that thinking and analyzing, and it just comes out of you. And I think a lot of the paintings that we look at of past masters, the ones that we really can identify with the emotions are the ones, and that are, you know, what we consider the great paintings, are the ones that they got themselves out of the way. I mean, you can actually, I think you can start to see differences in paintings where maybe we were in the way too much, and the ones that were really
good,
where we were out of the way. I mean,
yeah.
I think I can. I mean, I do. But that's,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's also kind of a process of deepening concentration, you know, to get into that flow where you get that sense of connection with the world that you're painting, so that you don't get a sense of a separate self painting this subject. And it seems like the longer you're kind of with the painting and you get involved with it, that it's like you're dropping into different layers of awareness almost.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, look, at the same time, I'm not saying that you can't be, you know, look, there's a part of you that has to be an editor, a critic, a cheerleader, you know, you have to be a very series of complex things while you're working on a painting.
Yeah.
Especially outdoors, you know, and you know the sun is moving constantly, the shadows are changing, and you have limited time, and it's a I find it just the spontaneity of it and the the thrill of it all, and the fact that, you know, you can mess up at any moment. And it's some sort of, I don't know, I find like this wonderful tightrope situation. I love it. I can't, you know, I love it. I there are times, I have to tell you, when I think to myself how goofy it must look. You know, I in some strange way, to be painting something so, you know, enormous outside, but how freeing it really is. I recently bought an easel. Should we get into this thing about the easel right now, or
do you have tell us a little bit about the equipment that you use and all that, like why you go into what you're going to
talk
about.
Yeah, I mean, you see, I was always for years I was trying to figure out, you know, whenever I saw pictures of Redfield, you know, in a book, or Daniel Garber, who were both Pennsylvania Impressionists, there was another, Walter Elmer Schofield, another guy, and they were always painting these large, super large, like 50 by 60s outdoors, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, what kind of an easel are they using? Because it was always the same kind of easel, but I eventually found out that it was a called a Gloucester easel, or an Anderson easel, a very specific kind of easel, and there are various different versions of it. And I found one on Jerry's Artorama. There's one called the Beauport easel, and you know, I purchased it, and this thing has become my best friend. I mean, you can put this thing together very, very quickly. It'll hold a 48 by 60 outdoors without any problem whatsoever. It doesn't blow over in the wind because the stance is so wide. You know, you might need to bring a little sandbag if it gets too windy outside. But the thing is just, like I say, and I'm not super mechanically inclined. You know, you can literally take this thing apart in about a minute and set it up in about a minute or so. And this thing's become my best friend. I've been taking it everywhere, and the first morning I used it, because I like painting large paintings, but I'll tell you, I was always like 40 by 50, and I was using sort of these easels that you know, I would like rig up a French sketch box and stuff like that I had sort of customized, you know, to some degree. But, you know, or if I took a 48, or if I took a large painting outdoors, I mean, sometimes I try to find some way to prop it outside, you know. But when I got this easel, I got to tell you, it was so easy to put this big canvas up on it and work outdoors, and I was just, I don't know, I just was like, I just so joyful out there. It was on a Sunday morning, and like, I was on the side of the road in Malibu, and a couple of joggers came by and gave me a thumbs up, and a couple of people came by on their bicycles. I think it was so early in the morning when I was working, I got that feeling that most people were still sleeping it off, you know. And and I was out standing in this field. It was great, you know, doing this big thing of the mountains with the morning light. And I don't know. It just, it was great. Great experience. I've taken it out many, many times already, and I got paint all over the car. But anyway. Yeah.
And your brush sizes?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. You know, without going all over the place, I mean, they're not. I don't use very large brushes. Part of the fun of painting something large is that, Linda, you guys are both painters, right? So,
right.
You'll know what I'm talking about. A lot of times, when you look into the woods, or you look at a hillside, or you look at the sky, which, you know, at first blush is, let's say, some form of blue, you know. But if you really look at it, you'll see how spotty it really is. And from, you know, and if you take a few, obviously from a distance it's blue, let's say, or a warm blue, okay, which, but, and can be warmer on one side than the other, you know, from where you know, the sky, because it could be, you know, as it gets close to the sun, obviously it warms up and, you know, cooler on the other side. But if you're looking at the sky, you know, you'll see different things going on in it, you know, and I'm you guys know exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And if you use too big a brush, I find you can lose the ability to do those color vibrations. So you're working inside of, let's say, colors that are in the same value, but one's warm and one's cool,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't actually use, you know, huge brushes, like house painter brushes on paintings that big. I move very, very fast.
And
but,
he
you
does.
Know, I'll, but I'll look
so
at
are
the
you
sky.
Using like a size 8 or a 10? Or
you know, I'd say an 8 or 10. I mean, rarely do I go to a 12, you know, to be honest
okay.
with you. I'll just, you know, but a lot of times to get those beautiful vibrations, you know, I'll just start. You need to lay out a lot of paint, you know. But I'll just start
yeah.
working in, you know, whatever the sky color is. If it's phthalo blue and white, so if it's phthalo blue and white, then you know phthalo blue is a blue that leans a little bit towards green, you know. So you know, you
mm-hmm.
might have to maybe knock it down slightly with some alizarin, you know. But
mm-hmm.
but you'll do it in ways where you're not completely mixing everything, and then, you know, if there's warm hits also dancing around in the sky, you know, I mean, I'm creating a make-believe sky, you know, you go for maybe a little, you know, cadmium orange or maybe a slight bit of cadmium yellow deep, but then you got to watch out that it's not going to go green on you, you know, but you're constantly working all these vibrations, because if you look closely at the Impressionists, those paintings were all about vibrations. They were all about broken color, you know.
Right.
They took it to the max, you know, but, you know, you can do, you know, let's say if you want maybe slightly more toned down versions of that, you know, but that's what I do. Everything you look at is vibrating. If you look at like a distant mountain range, you know, you could look at it and say, okay, the rocks are chiseled and this, that, and this, but there's greens in there and there's blue greens in there and there's some warmer greens and there's cooler things going on and there's all this wonderful stuff going on. And I find the best way to do that is to take, you know, not a big brush and just slap on the mountains, you know, but to literally work out these contours, but very, very quickly. And if it's going warm, then just go towards the warm green. If it's going cool, you know, go for the cools and just keep sculpting this thing and putting this thing together and just keep reacting to what you see. And obviously I try to, I mean, I'm, you know, I'm very cognizant and I try very, very hard to get the values as close as I can to what's going on, unless I consciously make a change, you know, to try to hopefully make the painting better. But in general, I'm just getting down, you know, what I see. You know, that's, you know, you're not just doing what you see in front of you because, you know, you're doing what you feel or something, and you know, what you feel about how you see of what's in front of you, if that makes any sense, you know. I think there's, you don't want to get caught up in, I find that there's too many artists who take, I think, too much of a degree in pride. And here's why I may start parting company with some people, and here's why you start to get the threatening letters, you know. But but Emil Gruppi warned about it. I think we talked about this last time. He warned in one of his books. He said that he thought that the younger oil painters that were coming up behind him were becoming too obsessed with their drawing and not enough with their painting. And I think there's too many people today doing work that looks more like illustration. And I don't mean illustration as a negative, because it's the best draftsmanship on the planet. You know, it absolutely is. But, you know, there's a big difference between painting and illustration. There just is. And
mm-hmm.
and you can spot it instantly, you know. But there's too many illustrators today, you know, painting landscapes, calling themselves artists. And to me, I'm not putting down what they do, but there's a big difference in doing that very safe, very unrisky, you know, kind of work, as opposed to the kind of work that guys like Redfield did and Garber did and Schofield did and George Wesley Bellows and Robert Henry and Emil Gruppi and, you know, all of those very unique, George Gardner Simons, I could go on and on and on, Hanson Potthoff in California, Maurice Braun. I mean, these guys were painters, you know, Sam Hyde Harris. They're painters. They're not illustrating. You know, they're painting, and I think painting is drawing is just a part of the painting process. You know, it's the same way like technical ability is part of the process of playing a musical instrument. But just because you can play every note on your instrument doesn't mean you should all the time. You know, a lot of times one or two notes say a lot more than 30, and running up and down your scales like a lunatic. You know, I'm also a musician a little bit, so, you know, but do you see what I'm getting at?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm actually out.
Are you guys
yeah.
sleeping? I'm waiting to hear snoring now.
We're not
sleeping. No.
Right.
We're not sleeping.
I was
sleeping.
Just thinking
we're taking
about
it in.
What you were saying and tying it back in earlier about taking yourself out of the equation, you know, and that spontaneous feeling that you have when you're painting, and you call it a wonderful tightrope situation. Mm-hmm. And when you're there and you're painting and you're just into it, do you ever clutch? Do you ever get a sense of, like, anxiety or that the painting's not, you know, going, not the way you want it to, because I understand what you're talking about, not being so tight and in control. But I'm just wondering about that clutch feeling where then you're, you know, you're really not in the flow yet. If that happens to you, and if it does, what do you do about that?
I'm absolutely impervious to that. No, I'm so being facetious. No, I think it happens. I think you can eliminate that. I think you can eliminate it. Okay. Whenever I've gotten in trouble, okay, now I don't get in trouble that much anymore. I do from time to time. And if I do start to slip into it, I've got various checklists to get out of it. But to answer the question properly, I think most paintings go wrong somewhere in the inception stage.
Mm-hmm.
And if those are sometimes very hard to correct, I mean, if you did something like really boneheaded in terms of like composition, and now you're halfway through the painting and you go, uh-oh, that was like really dumb what I did. Like, mm-hmm. I split this thing. You can split a painting directly in half. I mean, like people say not to. I mean, a lot of painters do it very successfully. I mean, Richard Schmidt does it all the time. He bisects his paintings. You know, right down his horizon line is in the middle a lot. I think he can get away with it because he'll make one half more interesting than the other half. You know, so if the two are equal, then your eye starts fighting. You know, the eye starts to fight, and you're not sure, what to look at. Then I could see where like the wheels would come off. But I think you can eliminate that problem very early on in the compositional stage. I mean, like when I, for instance, I did a very large painting outside about 3 weeks ago. And what I did was, and it was a 48 by 60. I did it outside. And oddly, it makes it even more ridiculous. It was of a very fleeting light situation. The effect would only probably last, let's say, half an hour to 45 minutes. And it was of looking through some trees just as the sun. Sorry?
I know the one you're talking about. Julie sent me a picture of it.
Oh, did she? And
yeah.
It was looking through some trees just as the sun went behind them and lit up all these, like, leaves to these bright chunks of yellow up against these oranges and these greens. And behind it, there was a mountain that was sort of this combination of purple and minty colors. I mean, it was just an explosion, okay? And I was with a friend of mine a day or two before, and we were walking around looking for places to paint. And he's an artist also. And we came across this one place, and I looked at it, and I said, holy cow. I said, wouldn't it be great to try to get that? And if you could do that in a large painting and get the energy, you know, because I just think there were so many little bits of color going on in all of those leaves and all of those branches and all of those. It was just like a riot of colors, the only way to describe it, you know. And but I was thinking to myself, how the hell could you do this in one shot? I mean, unless maybe you came back a few times, but I generally don't like to do that because I find that, I don't know, I'm like a different person day to day, and you know, the place never looks the same to me, even one day apart, you know. So I try to do it all at once. So what I did was I literally stood there and looked at it for about half an hour. I just stood there, kind of with my hands in my pockets, and, you know, I just took it in. It's almost like I let it into my lungs in some way. You know, I breathed it in. And I looked at it, and I really watched the whole effect, and I really, then I went home that night, and while I was lying in bed, before I went to sleep, I painted the whole painting in my head. I literally painted the whole painting in my head. I said, okay, I mean, like, I took that, like, I mean, I know it sounds ridiculous, but I saw myself putting the easel up and putting the canvas on the easel and laying out my paint and then, you know, getting my turpentine cup and how I was going to lay the sketch in and where my center of interest was going to be and where make sure I didn't have, like, I split my warms and cools, you know, that I was going to lean more towards one thing than another, and where my shadow pattern was going. And I literally painted the whole thing in my head. And then I went back out there about the next day, and then I set up and I sketched everything in before the light effect that I was looking for was going to happen. So by the time that light effect had come along, I'd already laid everything in. I'd already put down quite a bit of color, you know, because I knew that the sky was going to be a certain color and a certain value. And it was slightly, I would say, warmer. The sky was probably a little warmer than when I started. So I kind of knew in advance what to do. So I laid a couple of color notes in, and when that effect happened for 45 minutes, I tore through it like a madman, you know? So,
God, that's exciting.
Yeah, it was
that's
a ton
exciting.
Of fun.
Yeah,
so,
George, I don't think that's strange. I mean, I tend to do the same thing. A couple of the paintings that I've done, I've painted them a number of times in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Before I even put my brush on. So I don't think it's that strange to do what you did. It's just meditating to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the strange part was that I actually sometimes will think about driving to the location, parking the car, not in a control way, in a kind of, I can't wait to celebrate this moment, you know, get out of the car, set up the easel, you know, that I've got this little stand that I've, you know, the easel pal on it, lay out the paint, you know, I enjoy the process, you know, so, you know, pour the turpentine in the cup and then just start working. And I envision the painting, as you said, Linda, you know, I mean, yeah, in fact, Redfield even talked about it in one of his letters. He talked about, you know, seizing something, you know, like, you know, when you, to grasp, you know, take, seize, you know, not seeing, but seizing something that you see and somehow taking it back with you before you do it. Anyway, which I think is
interesting. You're probably even aware of, they've done research of, you know, the Olympic athletes seeing, like, the ski race and the moguls and just where they're going to turn and visualizing it so completely that your brain fires in such a way it actually conditions your muscles when you can visualize it that completely.
Yeah, I believe that.
So when you're talking about painting that painting in your head, you know, that makes perfect sense. It's really exciting, actually.
Yeah, it is, and you know, and I know maybe to someone who might be trying to overanalyze what we're saying, you know, they might say, well, isn't that control, you know, isn't that, you know, it's control to a degree, but what you're doing is you're teeing something up to completely be out of control or you know, not oversteering it in that moment, you know. I mean, it's like, I don't know if you know anything about golf. I mean, we talked about this last time, and I played a lot of golf in my time, you know, and the best way to hit the ball, you know, was to completely release, you know. It's like you can't, you can't muscle it. You can't. It's all centrifugal force hitting a golf ball, you know, and the strangest way to hit it the furthest, you have to be the loosest. You have to be absolutely in some, you know, like not, you're just sort of giving into something. You're giving into centrifugal force and gravity, and it, sorry, somebody keeps calling in while I'm on the phone. I don't recognize the number, sorry. It's Edward Redfield calling me from the great beyond. But anyway, that's, I think it's a very similar thing where you're just, you know, you did all your homework, you did all your background, you did all, you know what I mean, all your background study, you, in order to get to a place where you can just release, you know.
So you did your dress rehearsal.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and you don't really get into a lot of trouble at then, you know, because I find that, again, like the answer, the other thing that you were talking about is I think a lot of paintings get into trouble in the inception stage, you know, before you ever lay any paint down. You know, you made a critical error in terms of how you were going to design the painting, you know, or you didn't resolve all your compositional issues before you jumped into it. Because those are the only times they ever really get into trouble. I mean, sometimes you can get into a look, there's only so many reasons why a painting can be going wrong if you know kind of what you're doing. It's either a compositional issue, okay, or it's a color temperature issue. Mm-hmm. Where people start saying mud, the painting starts to get muddy. But if you're working from life and you're looking at really what's going on in front of you, it's hard for a painting to get muddy. You know, if you just keep really being clear in observing what's going on in front of you, you know, and then what was it? The Whistler said mud was a great color in the wrong place. I mean, there's no color that's intrinsically muddy because it's all relative, you know, because like, you know, that might be just the color you need in another painting, you know, that what is muddy. So it could be a color temperature problem or a value issue, but that's easy to check out. You start looking at is that darker than that or lighter than that? You know, those are the only basic places it can go wrong that I can think of. You know, we're not talking about, figure work. We're talking about landscape painting. Figure work, you know, a likeness, that's a whole other headache that I just, you know, if I want to add an extra branch to a tree to help the composition, I can just do whatever I want, which is great. I mean, you can't add an extra eye, you know, unless you can if you're Picasso, you know, God bless him, but that's not exactly what I'm doing, so, you know.
Well, George, there was a question on the Ammo Painting Challenge Facebook group.
Sure.
And so they brought this up, and we wanted to ask you, and that is, can you tell us, you know, how do you start a large canvas? What is your process? And is it really all that different from painting smaller? And so by large, you know, we mean 30 by 40 inches or larger versus smaller would be 16 by 20.
Or smaller.
And the further question is, do you think painting large influences what you paint?
I think those are great questions. Does it influence on what I paint? I don't know. To answer the first part, how do you start? I start in a much, that's a good question. The second half of that question is a great question. I have to think about that response because I take this stuff very seriously, and I don't want to ever knee-jerk and say something, you know, inaccurate and then send people down the wrong road, and then I feel like I said something stupid, you know. I think, to answer your question, I do the same basic process as you lay out the design of the canvas, and I just try to figure out as I do with anything, do I think this is going to be a worthwhile painting? I mean, what am I trying to say? Like, you know, like over the weekend, I went out and, you know, I saw, this is beautiful, but they weren't large pieces, but I mean, just beautiful fog was starting to break, and there were some patches of blue in the sky, but it was still mostly kind of grayish purples, you know, because there was like a heavy marine layer. I was out towards Malibu, and it was starting to break in the distance, and then there was these big, beautiful trees on the right-hand side, and an old kind of broken-down farmhouse, and the light was just hitting the farmhouse the right way, and there were some trees in front of it that still had some autumn colors. I mean, so I guess when I looked at that, I said to myself, well, you know, there's lots of dabs, you know, like I knew right away, like from looking at the tree line in the middle distance, there was just lots and lots and lots of these wonderful golden leaves. And they were like just kind of, you know, blowing, you know, in you know, they were like, you know, they look like they're sizzling almost, you know, because they're just you know, and they were just blowing beautifully, just still clinging to the branches. A few were falling, you know. So right away I said to myself, okay, well, those are going to be lots of dabs, you know, because I don't know any other way to do it than that, you know. And the trees were very, very dark, you know. So the branches were very, very dark, and they were very strong up against the farmhouse, which was, you know, behind it, that was catching the light. So so I don't think I would deal with it any differently. I mean, it's a composition, you know.
Okay.
I could get, but to answer your question, I think perhaps if you're dealing with a larger canvas, you can have a little more fun with it because you don't have to. You see, the big difference is when you're painting a smaller painting and you've got, let's say, trees or evergreen trees in middle distance, you could do those with a couple dabs and say, okay, those are the evergreen trees. But when you start dealing with larger canvases, those trees are now, they could be 8, 10, 12 inches on your canvas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, those aren't dabs anymore. You got to really deal with these things, you know. But deal with them in a way where Edward Redfield keeps calling me. It's amazing. This number just keeps coming up. I have no idea what it is. You know, you have to, you know, you have to deal with these things, you know, that require now a lot of drawing, let's say, or a lot of shaping, if they're not just dabs. So you can have, if you like that, which I do, you can have a lot more fun, and you can have a lot more, you know, you can work a lot more of what we talked about earlier, those warms and cools into things, you know, and, you know, you could get a little bit more into some of the architecture of, you know, of the farmhouse and stuff like that, because I noticed there were, you know, the roof of the farm, for instance, you had a lot of shingles and stuff, and some of them were catching light, and some of them were off the roof. You know what I mean? Some of them had chipped away. So there's a lot of really cool texture going on in the roof, which on the 16 by 20, I basically did the roof in a couple of strokes, and I tried to get the feeling that there were variations going on in the roof. Mm-hmm. But on a much bigger painting, I could have really had some fun with that roof. You know, there was actually a hole punched through part of it, you know, exposing, like, you could actually, like, look into the inside the attic of the place, you know, because it was just an old broken down building. And I could have included that in a larger piece where, you know, when you get into a smaller piece, if you don't watch out, it can get too spotty, you know, because here's a big difference. When you paint a 16 by 20, you're going to probably look at the painting, the best vantage point to look at the painting is about the same distance from which you're painting it. You know, meaning it's almost at arm's length. You know, you look at a painting like that, it may be, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet away, or if you want to get closer to see how the painting was done, maybe 2 feet. Do you see my point? But on a 50 by 60, you're not going to look at a 50 by 60 from 3-4 feet away. You're going to really step back and look at it. So it's a much different experience. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, it's got to get painted in a different way. because you're going to be doing a lot more, you know, variations and warms and cools inside of, you know, like all the grass in the foreground in that field. You know, you might have to invent something, you know, you put a lot of texture in it or something. You'll have to come up with some sort of invention or get more wrapped up in it, whereas on a smaller painting, you just go whoosh, 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 and just say, okay, that's the foreground, you know?
Right.
So yeah, it does affect to some degree. It does affect to some degree, I think, maybe what you paint, and I think it'll certainly affect how you paint it, you know?
Well, and it sounds like you, in a larger canvas, you do capture more, and then you have, you know, wonderful problems to solve for creating form.
Yeah.
And a lot of interesting shapes, colors, values in a larger piece that, as you say, you've edited or simplified that down in a smaller piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can also, you know, it's funny because if you look at all of those, some of those larger paintings that those guys did, I guess they do some technical no-nos, but I never cared about that stuff, and I'm not telling people to come up with weak solutions to things, you know. But, you know, I mean, I noticed that, like, a lot of times, like, when you get close to some of those Redfields or Garbers, you know, or, like I say, Walter Elmer Schofield, I keep mentioning them because they were three Pennsylvania Impressionists who worked very similarly on those big pink canvases outside, you know. But when you get very close, you can see sometimes that they, like, were outlining things, you know, which is kind of a no-no,
yeah.
I guess, you know. But, you know, they didn't care, you know what I mean? I think what happens is when you get a canvas that large sometimes and your values are getting so close, which happens, you know, if you have, like, a grayish fence, you know, up against... You know what I'm saying? Something in the distance
yeah.
that's a very similar value. If you don't watch out, you'll keep putting the fence up against the background, and you'll say, well, why isn't that working? You know, I mean, those values really are that close. Why aren't they working on my painting? Well, then you have to come up with some kind of solution where you either darken it or lighten it or maybe throw a shadow that's not really quite there. But, you know what I'm saying? You got to... That'll happen on larger paintings a lot because the further you step back away from it, from the canvas, you know, the more things are going to blend and meld. So, it's a little bit of a different approach at times. But,
well, so sometimes you can put a little drawing in at the end of the painting to help differentiate shape. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I find myself doing that, you know, and I like that effect. Mm-hmm. I know David LaFell, who's my dear friend. You interviewed him, right?
Yeah.
He gets a little ticked off when people do that, because he says that painting is not about line, and he is absolutely technically right, you know. But I like throwing a few lines here and there. To me, it's just one more tool. You know, it's one more.
Yeah.
It's one more club in the bag, as we say on the golf course. You know?
Thank you. That was a great answer.
Okay. Thank you.
I guess that takes us up to a little bit about, but let's actually jump into talking more about, in depth about Redfield and the Pennsylvania Impressionists, George, because I know that, you know, that, near and dear to your heart. You grew up in Jersey, right? New Jersey?
No. I grew up in Westchester County, New York, which is just above. Yeah, just above the city.
Okay, I was wrong for some reason.
No, that's I spent a lot of time. I the second I got a driver's license when I was 16, I was already into Redfield and those guys, and the first chance I got, how I didn't get killed is amazing, but I drove I drove down to Pennsylvania in a day and then back because I didn't want to tell my parents. Especially my dad would have taken a very dim view of why I drove several hundred miles because I wanted to stand where Edward Redfield stood and look down the street. He'd be like, who, what are you talking about? Yeah, go ahead.
But the interesting thing that when I was doing the research for the show that I thought was kind of interesting was that even though there was a colony of painters, they seemed to be very diverse in the way that they were capturing the landscapes around and what they were painting. Like Garber, you know, you think of him, and there's these luminous paintings of the Delaware River, and Spencer has these, you know, beautiful lyrical views of the mills and the tenement houses, and
yes, absolutely.
You know, and then you had Redfield, who was the impressionist scenes of New Hope, and you know, vibrant color and bold application, and you know, all of them were, I guess, all of them painted large canvases. But it's just really kind of interesting because typically when you have a colony, you have a number of artists that are typically working together, and you can pretty much tell that was, you know, the California Impressionists, for example, or the, you know, the Taos School or whatever.
Yes.
And this is a little bit different than that, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think it ever was a... It's funny. It was definitely a painter colony, you know, but because there was, it was, you know, a lot of, it was filled with artists. I mean, Redfield was the first guy to go there. Redfield was a guy that studied. He was a guy that he was with Robert Henry and all of that whole crew, and George Wesley Bellis. He was around at the same exact time. He went to Pennsylvania first. I'm not exactly sure why, and started painting there. And I think because his paintings, he became very, very popular early in his career, he drew other artists there. The one guy that he painted with a lot, his contemporary, was a guy named Walter Elmer Schofield. Now, I don't know if you know that story or not, and I don't know how much time you want me to waste, but they became sort of arch rivals. Do you know that story?
No, I don't.
No.
Well, they were best buddies, and Schofield was a guy that lived part time in England, but he would paint with Redfield in the wintertime. And the way I understand the story from everything I read, and Redfield, who lived to be 95, I think 96 years old, 96 years old, was still angry at Schofield. Redfield was interviewed when he was 95 by the local newspaper, and I believe it said in the article he was still angry, he wouldn't let it go. And Schofield has been dead for like 30 years, you know. But what – it just makes me laugh. But anyway, what had happened was, I guess Redfield said to Schofield, I'm going to do this painting of my front yard, and I'm going to look through these trees and paint the Delaware River beyond. And he basically described the painting that he was going to do for the National Academy show. And I guess Schofield went back to England and thought it was such a cool idea, he took a shot at it himself from memory, and then he entered it in a show that Redfield entered the same painting, and then he saw that Schofield had ripped off his idea, and that he was just livid. And I've got in this book I read about Redfield's letters, he's got his letter to Schofield saying, you stay the hell out of my front yard, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it just makes me laugh. I don't know why I get such a kick out of it. When two, like, men who achieve such phenomenal greatness still can't help but act like children, it just, I don't know why I get such a kick out of it. But... anyway, you know, when you think, like, people who have achieved such greatness can still be very petty, and I don't know, just, there's something very funny about it. But what was your question? I'm so sorry. Oh, the painter colony thing. So Schofield, he left. You know, he was never a full-time resident anyway, and because of, I think, Redfield's, you know, beautiful depictions of the area, within 20 years, a lot of painters started to arrive. Now, I know that Garber was more of a true teacher, you know, and took a lot of people under his wing. And I think Redfield, the only guy that really ever worked with Redfield was a guy named Nunemaker, was one of the artists. But Redfield wasn't a real teacher, and he wasn't much of a joiner, you know, of groups, as far as I could tell. He was very much a loner. In fact, the one of the galleries that represents me, the Bucks County Gallery, you know, the Bucks County Gallery of Fine Arts, said that people who live in New Hope that are older people now remember Redfield when they were a kid. They'd go up to Redfield, and this is like when he was in his 80s and he was painting, and they'd say, "Mr. Redfield, can we watch you?" And his response would be something I can't say on the radio.
Oh.
And he would chase these kids off, you know. But so
it's interesting that I find it interesting. I wrote down that he passed in 1965.
Yeah.
So his impressionist painters that he admired were Monet and Pissarro and others. But, you know, here's somebody that, you know, basically was alive in our generation, if you will, you know, quotes around that. But we're not talking somebody from the, you know, way back in the 17th century type of thing. We're looking at, you know, somebody here that was painting in our early 1900s.
Yeah, I mean, he sort of hit his stride, I guess, around 1915, you know. I don't know, that would put him, what, in his 30s already, right? I mean, he studied,
right.
He studied in, I think he was born in, wasn't he born in 1869?
Very
yeah,
good,
yeah. Yeah, he was, 1869.
Yeah. He worked with people who had worked with Monet. I mean, you know, he studied with, I mean, he really was probably the greatest, I don't know, probably for my money, the greatest time to be a landscape painter, you know, in America. I mean, there was a real feeling of nationalism going on. If you look at the history of the country at that time, you know, America was coming into its own. It was pre-World War I. There was an industrial revolution going on. There was an explosion in architecture, an explosion in art, you know, music across the board. It was a great time to be an artist.
The industrial age was coming into play.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great time for mankind, I think, in general, in terms of creativity. You know, obviously the two world wars kiboshed a lot of that. And I think, you know, also, which, you know, the Armory show, which I think unfortunately caused a split between, let's say, representational painters and you know, abstract painters. You know, it's incredibly sad to me that, you know, here you have two groups of artists, and I'm not an anti-modern art movement guy, you know. It's although I think a lot of it is ridiculous, okay, I want to make that clear too, but I'm not one of those, like, I'm not one of those hateful, vengeful guys that some other artists can be, you know, where, like, one thing is good and one thing isn't, you know, I mean, you know, I find it sad that because of a lot of art critics and art gallery owners in New York City at the time, that they sort of drove a wedge in between, you know, artists and said one thing is relevant and one thing is not relevant, and this is something
yeah.
that's going to be supported and this is something that's not going to be supported, you know, which I find is now leaked into literature, it's leaked into music, it's sort of seeped into the culture in an odd way, that anything that has any sense of, I mean, I notice it in movies, I notice it in screenwriting, and the way movies are reviewed, anything that has, let's say, some sense of history to it, or some sense of design, you know, based on solid fundamentals, is to be dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of times things that don't work, things that are in shambles, are somehow being misread as genius, or misread as positive, or misread as new. You know, it's not new. It's just not good. And
yeah.
You know, and it's yeah. I mean, not good has been around forever. There's nothing new about it.
Yeah.
But I think, and then I think there's a whole other egoist kind of thing that goes on with a lot of criticism, which is, you know, people want to separate themselves. I mean, this all comes from self-loathing, obviously, but, you know, you want to prove, you've got to prove to the world that you're a genius, so you point at something that clearly there's no genius to it, and you say, isn't this genius? And you instantly separate yourself from the masses, you know, because the masses don't have time for such nonsense. You know, they can look at it and go, no, that's terrible. You know, you know, but then these sort of, quote, geniuses can create this universe where only they see how genius this is, and it's old games. This is nonsense.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you shouldn't need roadmaps and instructions to look at art. You know, and you shouldn't. The same thing. It's the same thing as music. I mean, it's either a beautiful melody or it's noise. You know, and I'm not a big believer in the everything is relative. I used to believe that, but the more knowledgeable I became, and maybe as you get older, you know, and you spend tons and tons and tons of time, you know, learning about stuff and reading about something and getting better at something, where, like, you run out of excuses in your head. It's like, no, everything is not relative. And
right.
You know, some things just are good and some things just stink, you know. And I don't have patience for it anymore. You know, it's like, and if something's good, I really want to celebrate how good it is because it took somebody a long time to figure out how to do that. And if something stinks, it just stinks.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get into that. Well, you know, it's not, well, maybe it's just not my cup of tea. No, it's just awful. Let's just cut to the chase. Let's stop.
Well, there's something about Edward Redfield's work that really drew you to study him. And he doesn't stink.
No, not
but
at all.
What was it about his work that really spoke to you?
I'll tell you exactly what it was. I remember the time I was his work and work like it, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But I think he was the best practitioner of what got me excited about painting. I remember the first time I saw one of his paintings, and it was at Grand Central Art Galleries in New York City, and there was a show going on of Pennsylvania Impressionists, and I walked into the room, and the first thing that knocked me out was how huge some of these paintings were. Because it's a very intimate experience to look at a smaller piece or like a medium-sized piece, but these things were ridiculous. They were like, you know, 50 by 60s and 50 by 70s, and I was like, my God, these things were just ginormous, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you would walk into a room, and they were like getting punched in the head. They were so, at least it was for me, they were so beautiful and so overwhelming and so spontaneous. Now, I didn't know that these were I just knew I was feeling stuff emotionally. I didn't know about spontaneity or any of that. You know, I was sort of just learning how to paint myself. I mean, you're always learning how to paint, no matter how good you get. You know, you're still learning. But I remembered walking up to one of these paintings and getting close to it, and I was like, oh, my God, this doesn't look like anything. I remember, like, it's little funny squiggles and little chunks of stuff and just smudges and swirls, and it's like a big mess. It's like this beautiful mess, but it's like just stuff. And then I would step back and go, my God, that's a hillside, and that's a cloud, and there's a shadow of that cloud on that mountain, and there's all these trees. And then I would walk close again and go, no, they're just these funny, weird little lines. And then I'd step back and go, how do those look like trees if they're just weird little lines? And then I would walk close again. And that's how it started for me. I swear to God, I remember that very, very clearly. And there was something he had done of a bunch of, trees in the distance. And, like I say, and then sort of like these big leafy bushes, I remember, or something on the banks of a river. They're very indigenous to Pennsylvania, and they stay green even in the wintertime. So they have leaves. I don't know what they're called. Anybody from Pennsylvania knows instantly what I'm talking about. But it's a rhododendron. Does that sound right?
You're talking to somebody who lives out here in the mountains and deserts.
Okay.
That's not rhododendron. I'm wondering if you're talking about the cattails, that, or I call them cattails, that are right on the marshes, right next
they're
to the
big
river.
Leafy green. Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to kill like an hour talking about this, probably because I don't even know what I'm talking about. But anyway, I remember looking at a painting of these in the snow, and I was like, I just kept going back and forth. How do those look like bushes? And I would get close. They're just these big spotty, splattery things, and I couldn't figure it out. But anyway, for some reason, it got me, and I said, that's for me. I got to figure out, yeah, I got to figure out how a person can do something with such energy. And, you know, it was, I don't care free, I guess. Freedom, you know, to be like that, you know, the best, you know, when you say childlike, sometimes that can be like a mess, you know what I mean? I don't mean that, but to be open, to be that open like a child, tempered with knowledge that only an adult can have, you know, and to see like the best of that, you know, so pure. I said, that's for me. And then I started to research him, and I started to research the whole school. And then the guy that ran the gallery was this guy, John Evans, who was the nicest man in the world. We got to be very good friends, and he gave me my first show, like, you know, many, you know, like, I'd say, like, I was probably 16 or 17 when I first started going to the gallery. By the time I was 30, I had my first one-man show, and he gave it to me. But I had three shows there over time. But, you know, I would ask him, like, well, who's this guy? And he said, that's Edward Redfield. And who's that guy? That's Walter Elmer Schofield. Could you tell me about it? He was just a great guy. And he said, you know, he painted these outdoors all at once. And I'm like, what? I'm like, how do you know, like, you know, I couldn't believe it, you know. And anyway, so I got drawn in, and that's, and then I found out that very few people do it. And I understand why very few people do it. I mean, first of all, it's insane. And and it costs a lot of money to make large paintings and to throw around that amount of paint. You know, it's impractical, certainly. You know what I mean? Because who the heck's got that kind of wall space? But that's not why I paint, you know. I mean, I paint because I gotta do it, and I thankfully don't paint pictures, you know, that when I'm done I rub my hands together and say, I'm gonna sell this, you know. with this one I'll pay the rent. No, I do this stuff because I have to do it. It's for the sheer joy of doing it, and I think if, you know, not that this is a consideration at all, but I think any chance you've got of getting remembered at this isn't going to be by playing it safe, you know? So.
Mm-hmm. When you said earlier that, you know, there was the freedom and you, like a child, but the knowledge of an adult, I just heard recently that, you know, if you're wanting to learn something new, that your brain is the most elastic as an adult right after you laugh. And so that if you want to bypass your belief systems and learn something new and have the elasticity of a child, you can laugh. And yet it seems
I like that
when
a
you're
lot.
Painting, yeah, when you're painting and you want that freedom and that spontaneity, you know, you're kind of going for the same thing. And when you, the way you've described how you approach your subject and the excitement of the colors and the color vibrations and the composition and the design, there's so much joy there that, you know, it just, you know, it's just got to keep your brain young.
Well, I'll tell you part of the joy of it, too, you know. I'm 56 years old now, okay? And when you spend a lot of your life, you know, trying to figure out how to do something the absolute best you can.
Mm-hmm.
And you think of all the times you messed up, and you say, I've been painting since I'm 13 years old. That's 43 years I'm doing this, you know, and doing a lot. I mean, despite the fact that I, you know, the movie work, I paint a lot. I paint a lot more than a lot of, let's say, artists who do that solely, you know what I mean? Because, like, my, I, you know, a lot of my very dear friends are painters, tonight. They go, what'd you do this week? And then I went out and I did like 4 or 5 plate air paintings. Like, they go, like, God, you paint a lot of paintings. I'm like, yeah, I'm always at it. I'll be doing something 3 days after I'm dead. You know, I'm just like one of those personalities, a restless soul that way, you know. But I can't tell you how part of the excitement is that you finally got a handle on something that eluded you for so many years.
Yeah.
I mean, the joy of being able to see something and set your easel up and say, I'm going to get this, and I'm going to get all of it. I'm going to get it really, really good. You know, I mean, I'm going to get it, and I'm going to do it in the next 3-4 hours. You know, like you look at something and go, okay, I own this. I'm going to really do this, and I'm going to and it's there's such a sense of joy that the last 43 years weren't a waste of time. You know, it's like it's those moments when you're out there swinging and it's working. You go, that's why I put all the years into it,
mm-hmm.
so that I could move at the speed of thought. I could just do this and glide through this, and if I get into trouble, I'll get out of it, you know, because I've made every mistake there is, and I'll figure out what's wrong. And that's, to me, that's part of the joy of doing it, you know, because, you know, again, I don't know if I'd be redundant now, but, you know, because you put all the time into it, and not that it ever becomes effortless, but it gets close to effortless sometimes, you know. And those are the moments where you're just very happy. Of course,
yeah.
You know, the next thing I do will probably stink, you know, after this long diatribe about effortless painting, you know. I'll be, you know, but what's great about it is no one ever gets to see the bad ones, you know. You just sort of scrape them down and...
Yeah. Unless you share them on your Facebook page, then everybody gets to see them. So.
Yeah, well, I don't.
I don't do that.
No, my wife won't let me. You know, Julie, she's my harshest critic. You know, she sets me straight. You know.
Yeah, she keeps you in line. I'll say that.
Oh yeah, she'll look at it and go, "What is that?" Oh, that's.
Thank you, dear. Yeah, I have that critic here in the house too. So.
Do you? Is that a barn or is that a tree? What is that thing? What thing? That green thing.
I'll be busy working on one area of the painting.
Say what? Say that again.
I said I'll be busy working on one area of the painting, and he'll come up and go, "What's this over here? Something I haven't gotten to yet. Get out of my studio."
I know. Believe me, I get it. I get it. You know.
But we are coming down to the last, like, 15 minutes of the show here. Yeah. So what I wanted to do is, one thing I wanted to cover, George, was you and I had a conversation that I think was really beneficial to me and actually got me back into my studio and painting and enjoying painting again. And it was a story about somebody, and we won't mention names, but somebody telling you that a certain type of nature needed to be handled a certain way, and I think you know what I'm probably trying to get at, right?
No, I don't know what you're talking about at all.
Oh, okay. You know, how water should be handled, let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah.
What I was getting to was, what I liked about our conversations was that, you know, you need to tell a story, but basically...
Well, I look, again, if this is what you're talking about, I was, you know, earlier on I would hear a lot of painterly do's and don'ts, you know, like, you can't do this, you can't do that, no, you know, and I think a lot of it was well-meaning stuff, but nearly all of it ended up being completely ridiculous and pointless. And
mm-hmm.
if you're talking about, someone said to me, water must be handled simply, you know, and is that what you're talking about, that all water should be handled simply? Well, I remembered that resonating, you know, with me for a while. But then, you know, and then another thing was, someone once said to me, or many people said to me, you shouldn't finish one part of a canvas before you get to the other, and that you should get everything down first, cover the canvas as quickly as possible. Well, one thing I heard for years, just get it mm-hmm. covered, and then you can go in and adjust it. Now, somewhere in my brain, that never added up, because I was like, well, why would you put it down wrong and fix it later? When I try to get it right at first, that was just the way my brain, well, that's not how it's done, and blah, 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 blah. And I remember I went to an exhibition of, and now we're coming back around to Redfield, oddly enough, but
in
the show there were, I'm sorry?
There's a method in my madness.
Yeah, and I saw there were a few paintings of his in this one show, and they were paintings he never completed. And the first thing I noticed how complete sections were totally done and the canvases was totally white in other areas, which meant he was finishing as he went, you know,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
which is what I tend to do, because it never made any sense to me, because the more of it I got down wrong, it just got more and more confusing to me. So what I try to do is lay down something very quickly that's correct, and then I can lay down something correct next to that and something correct next to that, and the painting starts to paint itself at some point, because if I got three or four values on the canvas that are right, well, how many values are there anywhere that painters use? Nine? So, I mean, or five if you're Sargent, right? You never use, I think, more than five values. So as soon as I get a couple of things right on the canvas, it gets, and if I have a good composition to start with, I shouldn't mess up that bad, because from then on out, as I'm working, if I get jammed up, it's either got to be warmer or cooler or lighter or darker. I mean, it's not that complicated, you know? And then mm-hmm. what shape is it, basically? And what's the edge? Is it a sharper edge or a softer edge than the other things I've got on the canvas that I already know are right? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, but anyway, and then the thing, so, the thing that Linda was talking about the water should be handled simply, you know, and Redfield's water and all my favorite painters, the water looked like it was so complicated, and it looked like confetti or toothpaste or spaghetti. I mean, it was just madness to me the way they painted water, and they got the energy of the water better than any artist I've ever seen. I mean, so I think the worst thing in the world you can do is you start getting into these do's and don'ts. I mean, there are some that make sense, like, but none of them are written in stone, you know what I mean? I don't think it's a great idea to split a canvas in half unless you're doing it purposely and you want to know why. And I don't think it's a great idea to have the center of interest, you know, too far towards either edge of the canvas, but you can also do that successfully. You know, you know what I mean? The whole learning process is... there's a lot of gray areas in the do's and don'ts, but I wouldn't pay. I would paint what I see, and I would paint with what I feel about what I see, and stop getting so caught up in the do's and don'ts, because, you know, you may come up with something that nobody else has thought of, and you're not going to ever come up with something that no one's ever thought of if you're painting the way everybody else paints. You know, I mean, how are you ever going to get there? You know,
right? And that was, you know, it was real inspiring. When we had that talk, to hear that, because it's enabled me to go back into my studio and just paint.
Yeah, you got to cut loose. You really do. And I think, yeah, I mean, there are too many, and sometimes painters can be the worst. What I mean by literally, other artists can be the far more judgmental. And I caught myself earlier on. At time, I'm not judgmental by nature, and I'm like, yeah, well, you know, I kind of have a yeah, whatever approach about a lot of things. I mean, although I take it very seriously, I don't think just because I have my discovery of the week, everybody else has to march along with me, and everyone who isn't doing it just the way I'm doing it is an idiot. You know, this just happens to be my discovery, and this is how I'm doing it, and this works for me. But mm-hmm. I know a lot of painters who will, like, look at stuff and go, oh, you can't do that. I'm like, well, why not? You can't do that. Well, why? Because you just can't. I'm like, well, I can't applies to, like, you know, other things. This is art. This is painting. Tell me why. Well, yeah, I don't know. You just can't. I'm like, all right, this conversation is done. You know. Because some guy said something when you were in the seventh grade isn't a good enough reason for me. You know.
paint outside the line.
Huh?
Don't paint outside the line.
Yeah. Well, you can't outline a form. I mean, really? Well, Van Gogh did it. His paintings go for hundreds of millions. So, I mean, someone should tell him, you know.
Exactly. So, okay, so. Barbara, you have a last question, and I also want to be able to talk a little bit about George's show that's coming up and some workshops he's got coming up, too. So.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you ever take a painting that you've worked on outside and do any more work on it in the studio.
Yeah, I mean, as a general rule, you know, I try not to, meaning because I don't want to give myself an out as I'm working on location, like, well, I'll fix this later, or I'll fix this later, because, mm-hmm. you know, then you could be getting sloppy. I try to get it absolutely done to the best of my ability on location, unless for some reason the clouds come rolling in, or I'm getting attacked by bugs, you know, which happened recently. I don't know, but there was like a swarm of gnats that found me just fascinating. And I was spraying off, you know, that stuff off on me to keep them away. And it was like perfume or something. They just were all over me. So that caused me to stop. You know, I said, all right, enough, guys, you win. So, but generally, no, I try to get it as, you know, really done on location, and then when I get it home, while it's still wet, generally that evening or the next morning I'll take a quick peek at it, and if I have to make some little tiny adjustment, that's what I'll do. But I find sometimes if you don't watch out, you can overwork them and you start killing a lot of the spontaneity of what made it, you know, good in the first place. And you know, like a little edge or something like that, or maybe a ladder branch to a tree or something. But I try to get them done, you know. Other than that, I try to avoid it. I mean, have I, like, 6 months later looked at a painting and saw a passage and, you know, if I just add a highlight or something? Yeah, I've done that. But I find that if you start working them over too much, they just lose everything that was right about them, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you make them better. A lot of times you just make them different, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, George, you've got a show coming up next week at the Wynn.
I do?
The World of Art Showcase. Yes,
you do. Oh, no, I didn't know
next
that.
Next week.
Sorry.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's very exciting.
Yeah. Starts December 22nd, or December 20th, and ends on the 22nd.
Right.
And you want to talk a little bit about that show? Or?
Yes, it's the World of Art Showcase, and it's at the Wynn Hotel. And there were 70 painters that were, I think, said there's like about 70 or plus painters. And I was one of a very lucky group of painters that got invited. And it's going to be a real celebration of art. There's going to be all different kinds of art there. There's going to be I'm about the only, I think, straight landscape painter in the show. I think there's some great figurative work, and then there's some modern stuff, and it's being billed as the greatest art show in the last 100 years. That's, which is, I think, high expectations, but it does look like it's going to be a spectacular event. There's going to be like the greatest wines and open bars, but all kinds of like wild booze that they're going to have. And I'm on the wagon, so that's no good for me. But there's going to be like terrific food there. I believe there's going to be like an orchestra, you know what I mean, like playing. And then you get to wander around and buy paintings, you know, from living artists. And it's like really, really high end. And I'm really honored to be a part of it. And I'm going to have about close to 25 of like the best paintings of that I've ever done. I mean, it's like the best of my work is going to be there. And a couple of those big goofy paintings I did, I'll have about three or four of those. Yeah.
And if you go out to the World of Art Showcase, I think it's .com, or even if you just Google World of Art Showcase and go to artists and click on George's thing, he's got a video out there. That actually, George, we ought to talk about maybe
when this is over, loading that up to your website and loading it up to Facebook too.
It is on Facebook now, and it is on my website now. Website, it's on videos. But my friend, actually another artist, George Kappas, who was also in the show, his friend Joe, he shot that video. Of Joe Top shot that video of me painting, and I did a 30 by 40 outside, and I do it in one shot. You can see it. He had a time lapse over my left shoulder, and I did that painting in a couple of hours, maybe. And
really fascinating. Yeah. So if you want to see George painting large, and that would be like a great video to watch.
For me, that's a miniature.
Be great.
That 30 by 40 is a miniature for me, you know. So, no, I'm joking. No, that's about mid-size, you know.
Right. And your website is georgegallo.com, right? So we must take it to your website to see that video.
Yes, that is my website, yes.
Yeah.
George Gallo, Fine Art. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
That is,
and
right?
I'm sorry?
It's ggallo.com.
Okay, ggallo.com.
Yeah.
And also listed there are some workshops you got coming up too, right? And
I have a workshop coming up, yes. I have a workshop coming up in January. Hold on a second. What's the date? The 21st to the 23rd at the Carmel Art Institute. And that's going to be a lot of fun. So that's like a Monday to Tuesday, Wednesday. So I'll do a big painting demo outside, you know, in Carmel by the ocean if the waves don't take me out, you know. So I'll probably do like one of those really super, you know, large ones out there, the demo, and then I'll teach the other 2.5 days. It's run by a guy named Rocco Rodiman, who's great guy. It's the whole Carmel Art Institute's a lot of fun, and I've got a lot of the people who have enrolled who. That were with me on Weekend with the Masters. So I don't know. I've been told by it because I email a lot of these students, you know, because we just stay in touch and they keep telling me that I've inspired them. And I'm like, good. You know, I mean, I'm happy to. I'm not trying to inspire people. I just can't help it. You know?
You're doing a good job of that.
I just get excited about this stuff, you know. So.
Yeah.
But if anybody else wants to join up, we'd love to have you. We'll be painting on the shores of Carmel and Monterey, and it's going to be beautiful, and we'll, at the very least, we'll laugh a lot. So I'm not a I'm not a teacher that gives the students a hard time, but you know, I don't think you know, I think you only learn by you know, being open and giving people, all the endless possibilities that you can have, you know, with a paintbrush. So.
Right. And then you also are going to be part of the Plein Air Convention that's coming up in April.
Right. 23rd. Right. I'm in the Plein Air Convention, and I'm going to be doing, for sure, I'm going to be doing a big demo out there, and that's in Monterey also. And that's April, what's the date on that, Linda?
April 10th. I think is when it
April
starts.
10th?
Yeah, April 10th through the 14th.
To the 14th? Okay, and I'll be there one of those days. And then I'm doing something in May, I think, at the San Clemente Art Supply. Yeah. And then...
Okay. That's not on your website, Jared.
That's what, Josh?
That's not on your website.
Okay, yeah, that will be up shortly. Would you say, Josh, I'm sorry?
It's the 11th and 12th.
The 11th and 12th of what? Of May. I'll be doing. I'll be teaching a workshop there, and I'll be
so
doing
plenty
some
of opportunity.
Sorry.
Plenty of opportunities to study with you.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, I mean, I love teaching. I really do. First when I was asked to do it by Weekend with the Masters, I wasn't sure if I was going to like it or not, or if yeah. But I do love it. I do love it. You know, the funny thing is about a lot of artists or a lot of students is I don't think they realize how good they are or how close they are. I'm always shocked.
That's encouraging.
That's the truth. I am always shocked that, like, some student will say, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. My painting's a mess. And I'll say, I said, do you have any idea how close this is? And they'll say no. And sometimes I'll say, look, do you mind if I just touch one little part of your canvas with your brush? And they'll say, okay, go ahead. And I'll just go highlight, shadow, and then they go, oh, my God, what'd you just do? I said, you were that close. And I put two dabs down, and you just don't know the last two dabs. I think you did all the hard work. I mean, you got the value of the sky right. That shape of that tree is right. It may have been a little flat. You just didn't have the highlight and the shadow, but it was all there ready to go. I mean, you know, a lot of times I'll dig up old work, you know. Like, I'll dig up paintings I did 30 years ago, you know. Like, I've got them all on, you know, basically in racks. And I'll pull one out that's, you know, on the surface, it's pretty horrendous, okay. But I look at it, and I'll say to myself, you know, by what I know today as opposed to what I didn't know 30 years ago, this is 5 minutes away from being a really good piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that I'll go back into it, but had I only done this and done that and sharpened that and softened that, you know, I was there. It really was not that far off. So I always find that students they get really excited when you show them how close they really are, which a lot of times they really are. They just got to take the ball the last 2 yards, you know. So.
Well, we are we're like way over time now. So.
Oh, okay. So George, shut up.
No, I'm not saying that. I always love talking with you, and you know that. So.
I know. I love talking with you too.
I do want to thank you for joining us and
taking
time with us. Like I said, our next show is January 17th with Kwang Ho, and. We certainly hope that everyone here shares this show with George, with everyone, other friends and fellow artists, so that everybody can hear your encouraging words, because that's the one thing I do like about you, George, is you're very encouraging and very positive, even when you're teaching your workshops. So if you want a nice infusion of feeling positive while you're out there painting, go paint with George. So he's a lot of fun.
That sounds great.
Please tell Kwang Ho I said hello, and he's also a very good golfer. Did you know that?
Yes, I did. And actually, he's golfed on a golf course up here where I live, believe it or not.
Okay.
Called Weatherwax.
So
I told him the next time that he comes to play Weatherwax, he has to call me, because I also play golf.
Yeah, because I saw him playing hooky at Weekend with the Masters. You know, I was out there working, and I looked, and there was Kwang Ho. He was carrying his bag across the fairway out there.
Yeah, he played hooky at AIS, too, and went and played golf with his brother in between Cincinnati and Indianapolis somewhere. So
that's funny.
Yeah, so
that, good. Yeah. Well, tell him I said hello.
So I will do that. And do a little quick shout-out to Blanche and hope that she feels better.
Yes,
she was
Blanche,
under
feel
the
better.
Weather. Yeah. So, and we'll catch everyone next time on January 17th. Thank you again, George, for being with us. And
thank you, ladies, very much. I had a lot of fun.
Thank you, George. It was very inspiring. It was great.
All right, you got it. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And then we want to end with everybody having a great night and a great holiday, and we'll catch everybody in the new year. Thanks, everyone. Have a good evening.